The Military Conference of August 22, 1939. The generals found Hitler in one of his most arrogant and uncompromising moods. No official minutes of Hitler's harangue have been found, but several records of it, two of them made by high-ranking officers from notes jotted down during the meeting, have come to light. One by Admiral Hermann Böhm, chief of the High Seas Fleet, was submitted at Nuremberg in Admiral Raeder's defense, and is published in the original German in Trial of the Major War Criminals, Volume 41, pages 16 to 25. General Halder made voluminous notes in his unique Gabelsberger shorthand, and an English translation of them from his diary entry of August 22nd is published in Documents on German Foreign Policy, Volume 7, pages 557 to 559. The chief document of the session used by the prosecution as evidence in the Nuremberg trial was an unsigned memorandum in two parts from the OKW files, which were captured by American troops at Saalfelden in the Austrian Tyrol. It is printed in English translation in Nazi Conspiracy and Aggression, Volume 3, pages 581 to 586, Nuremberg Document 798-PS, pages 665 to 666, Nuremberg Document 1014-PS, and also in Documents on German Foreign Policy, Volume 7, pages 200 to 206. The original German text of the two-part memorandum is, of course, in the Trial of the Major War Criminals volumes. It makes Hitler's language somewhat more lively than do Admiral Böhm and General Halder, but all three versions are similar in content, and there can be no doubt of their authenticity. At Nuremberg, there was some doubt about a fourth account of Hitler's speech, listed as Nuremberg Document C-3, Nazi Conspiracy and Aggression, Volume 7, pages 752 to 754, and though it was referred to in the proceedings, the prosecution did not submit it in evidence. While it undoubtedly rings true, it may have been embellished a little by persons who were not present at the meeting at the Berghof. In piecing together Hitler's remarks, I've used the records of Böhm and Halder and the unsigned memorandum submitted at Nuremberg as evidence. "I have called you together," he told them, "to give you a picture of the political situation in order that you may have some insight into the individual factors on which I have based my irrevocable decision to act, and in order to strengthen your confidence. After that, we shall discuss military details." "First of all," he said, "there were two personal considerations. My own personality and that of Mussolini. Essentially, all depends on me, on my existence, because of my political talents. Furthermore, the fact that probably no one will ever again have the confidence of the whole German people as I have. There will probably never again in the future be a man with more authority than I have. My existence is therefore a factor of great value. But I can be eliminated at any time by a criminal or a lunatic. The second personal factor is the Duce. His existence is also decisive. If something happens to him, Italy's loyalty to the alliance will no longer be certain. The Italian court is fundamentally opposed to the Duce. Franco, too, was a help. He would assure Spain's benevolent neutrality. As for the other side," he assured his listeners, "there is no outstanding personality in England or France." For what must have been a period of several hours, broken only by a late lunch, the demonic dictator rambled on. "And there is no evidence from the records that a single general, admiral, or air force commander dared to interrupt him, to question his judgment, or even to challenge his lies. He had made his decision in the spring, he said, that a conflict with Poland was inevitable, but he had thought that first he would turn against the West. In that case, however, it became clear to him that Poland would attack Germany. Therefore, she must be liquidated now. The time to fight a war, anyway, had come. For us, it is easy to make the decision. We have nothing to lose. We can only gain. Our economic situation is such that we cannot hold out more than a few years. Goering can confirm this. We have no other choice. We must act. Besides the personal factor, the political situation is favorable to us. In the Mediterranean, rivalry among Italy, France, and England. In the Orient, tension. England is in great danger. France's position has also deteriorated. Decline in birth rate. Yugoslavia carries the germ of collapse. Romania is weaker than before. Since Kemal's death, Turkey has been ruled by small minds, unsteady, weak men. All these fortunate circumstances will not prevail in 2 to 3 years. No one knows how long I shall live. Therefore, a showdown, which it would not be safe to put off for 4 to 5 years, had better take place now." Such was the Nazi leader's fervid reasoning. He thought it highly probable that the West would not fight, but the risk nevertheless had to be accepted. Had he not taken risks? In occupying the Rhineland when the generals wanted to pull back? In taking Austria, the Sudetenland, and the rest of Czechoslovakia? Hannibal at Cannae, Frederick the Great at Leuthen, and Hindenburg and Ludendorff at Tannenberg, he said, took chances. So now we also must take risks which can only be mastered by iron determination. There must be no weakening. It has done much damage that many reluctant Germans in high places spoke and wrote to Englishmen after the solution of the Czech question. The Führer carried his point when you lost your nerve and capitulated too soon. Halder, Witzleben, and Thomas, and perhaps other generals who had been in on the Munich conspiracy, must have winced at this. Hitler obviously knew more than they had realized. At any rate, it was now time for them all to show their fighting qualities. Hitler had created Greater Germany, he reminded them, by political bluff. It had now become necessary to test the military machine. The army must experience actual battle before the big final showdown in the West. Poland offered such an opportunity. Coming back to England and France, "The West has only two possibilities to fight against us. One, blockade. It will not be effective because of our self-sufficiency and our sources of aid in the East. Two, attack from the West from the Maginot Line. I consider this impossible. Another possibility is the violation of Dutch, Belgium, and Swiss neutrality. England and France will not violate the neutrality of these countries. Actually, they cannot help Poland." Would it be a long war? No one is counting on a long war. If Herr von Brauchitsch had told me that I would need 4 years to conquer Poland, I would have replied, "It cannot be done. It is nonsense to say that England wants to wage a long war." Having disposed, to his own satisfaction at least, of Poland, Britain, and France, Hitler pulled out his ace card. He turned to Russia. The enemy had another hope, that Russia would become our enemy after the conquest of Poland. The enemy did not count on my great power of resolution. Our enemies are little worms. I saw them at Munich. I was convinced that Stalin would never accept the English offer. Only a blind optimist could believe that Stalin would be so crazy as not to see through England's intentions. Russia has no interest in maintaining Poland. Litvinov's dismissal was decisive. It came to me like a cannon shot as a sign of a change in Moscow toward the Western powers. I brought about the change toward Russia gradually. In connection with the commercial treaty, we got into political conversations. Finally, a proposition came from the Russians for a non-aggression treaty. 4 days ago, I took a special step which brought it about that Russia announced yesterday that she is ready to sign. The personal contact with Stalin is established. The day after tomorrow, Ribbentrop will conclude the treaty. Now Poland is in the position in which I wanted her. A beginning has been made for the destruction of England's hegemony. The way is open for the soldier, now that I have made the political preparations. The way would be open for the soldiers, that is, if Chamberlain didn't pull another Munich. I am only afraid, Hitler told his warriors, that some Schweinehund, dirty dog, will make a proposal for mediation. At this point, the meeting broke up for lunch, but not until Goering had expressed thanks to the Führer for pointing the way and had assured him that the armed services would do their duty. According to the account in Nuremberg document C-3, Goering jumped up on the table and gave bloodthirsty thanks and bloody promises. He danced around like a savage. The few doubtful ones remained silent. This description greatly nettled Goering during an interrogation at Nuremberg on August 28th and 29th, 1945. "I dispute the fact that I stood on the table," Goering said. "I want you to know that the speech was made in the Great Hall of Hitler's private house. I did not have the habit of jumping on tables in private homes. That would have been an attitude completely inconsistent with that of a German officer." "Well, the fact is," Colonel John H. Amon, the American interrogator, said at this point, "that you led the applause after the speech, didn't you?" "Yes, but not on the table," Goering rejoined. The afternoon lecture was devoted by Hitler mainly to bucking up his military chiefs and trying to steel them for the task ahead. The rough jottings of all three records of the talk indicate its nature. The most iron determination on our part, no shrinking back from anything. Everyone must hold the view that we have been determined to fight the Western powers right from the start. A life-and-death struggle. A long period of peace would not do us any good. A manly bearing. We have the better men. On the opposite side, they are weaker. In 1918, the nation collapsed because the spiritual prerequisites were insufficient. Frederick the Great endured only because of his fortitude. The destruction of Poland has priority. The aim is to eliminate active forces, not to reach a definite line. Even if war breaks out in the West, the destruction of Poland remains the primary objective, a quick decision in view of the season. I shall give a propagandist reason for starting the war, never mind whether it is plausible or not. The victor will not be asked afterward whether he told the truth or not. In starting and waging a war, it is not right that matters, but victory. Close your hearts to pity. Act brutally. 80 million people must obtain what is their right. The stronger man is right. Be harsh and remorseless. Be steeled against all signs of compassion. Whoever has pondered over this world order knows that its meaning lies in the success of the best by means of force. Having thundered such Nietzschean exhortations, the Führer, who had worked himself up to a fine fit of Teutonic fury, calmed down and delivered a few directives for the campaign ahead. Speed was essential. He had unshakable faith in the German soldier. If any crises developed, they would be due solely to the commanders losing their nerve. The first aim was to drive wedges from the southeast to the Vistula, and from the north to the Narew and the Vistula. Military operations, he insisted, must not be influenced by what he might do with Poland after her defeat. As to that, he was vague. The new German frontier, he said, would be based on sound principles. Possibly he would set up a small Polish buffer state between Germany and Russia. The order for the start of hostilities, Hitler concluded, would be given later, probably for Saturday morning, August 26th. The next day, the 23rd, after a meeting of the OKW section chiefs, General Halder noted in his diary, "Y Day definitely set for the 26th, Saturday." Allied stalemate in Moscow. By the middle of August, the military conversations in Moscow between the Western democracies and the Soviet Union had come to a virtual standstill, and for this the intransigence of the Poles was largely to blame. The Anglo-French military missions, it will be remembered, after taking a slow boat to Leningrad, had arrived in Moscow on August 11th, exactly 1 week after the frustrated Mr. Strang had left the Russian capital, obviously relieved to be able to turn over to the generals and admirals the difficult and unpleasant job of trying to negotiate with the Russians. A humiliating experience, Strang had called it in a dispatch to the Foreign Office on July 20th. What now had to be worked out hurriedly was a military convention which would spell out in detail just how and where, and with what, Nazi armed force could be met. But as the confidential British minutes of the day-to-day military conversations and the reports of the British negotiators reveal, the Anglo-French military team had been sent to Moscow to discuss not details, but rather general principles. The Russians, however, insisted on getting down at once to hard, specific, and, in the Allied view, awkward facts. And Voroshilov's response to the Allied Declaration of Principles made at the first meeting by General Dumont was that they were too abstract and immaterial, and do not oblige anyone to do anything. "We are not gathered here," he declared coolly, "to make abstract declarations, but to work out a complete military convention." The Soviet marshal posed some very definite questions. Was there any treaty which defined what action Poland would take? How many British troops could reinforce the French army on the outbreak of the war? What would Belgium do? The answers he got were not very reassuring. Dumont said he had no knowledge of Polish plans. General Haywood answered that the British envisaged a first contingent of 16 divisions, ready for service in the early stages of a war, followed later by a second contingent of 16 divisions. Pressed by Voroshilov to reveal how many British troops there would be immediately on the outbreak of war, Haywood replied, "At the moment there are 5 regular divisions and 1 mechanized division in England." These paltry figures came as an unpleasant surprise to the Russians, who were prepared, they said, to deploy 120 infantry divisions against an aggressor in the West at the very outbreak of hostilities. As for Belgium, General Dumont answered the Russian question by saying that French troops cannot enter unless and until they are asked to, but France is ready to answer any call. This reply led to the crucial question before the military negotiators in Moscow, and one which the British and French had been anxious to avoid. During the very first meeting, and again at a critical session on August 14th, Marshal Voroshilov insisted that the essential question was whether Poland was willing to permit Soviet troops to enter her territory to meet the Germans. If not, how could the Allies prevent the German army from quickly overrunning Poland? Specifically, on the 14th, he asked, "Do the British and French general staffs think that the Red Army can move across Poland, and in particular through the Vilna Gap and across Galicia, in order to make contact with the enemy?" This was the core of the matter. As seeds wired London, the Russians had now raised the fundamental problem on which the military talks will succeed or fail, and which has indeed been at the bottom of all our difficulties since the very beginning of the political conversations, namely, how to reach any useful agreement with the Soviet Union as long as this country's neighbors maintain a sort of boycott which is only to be broken when it is too late. If the question came up, and how could it help coming up, Admiral Drax had been instructed by the British government on how to handle it. The instructions, revealed in the confidential British papers, seem unbelievably naive when read today. The line of argument he was to take in view of the refusal of Poland and Romania even to consider plans for possible cooperation was: an invasion of Poland and Romania would greatly alter their outlook. Moreover, it would be greatly to Russia's disadvantage that Germany should occupy a position right up to the Russian frontier. It is in Russia's own interest, therefore, that she should have plans ready to help both Poland and Romania should these countries be invaded. If the Russians propose that the British and French governments should communicate to the Polish, Romanian, or Baltic states proposals involving cooperation with the Soviet government or general staff, the delegation should not commit themselves but refer home. And this is what they did. At the August 14th session, Voroshilov demanded straightforward answers to his questions. "Without an exact and unequivocal answer," he said, "continuance of the military conversations would be useless. The Soviet military mission," he added, "cannot recommend to its government to take part in an enterprise so obviously doomed to failure." From Paris, General Gamelin counseled General Dumont to try to steer the Russians off the subject, but they were not to be put off. The meeting of August 14th, as General Dumont later reported, was dramatic. The British and French delegates were cornered, and they knew it. They tried to evade the issue as best they could. Drax and Dumont asserted they were sure the Poles and Romanians would ask for Russian aid as soon as they were attacked. Dumont was confident they would implore the marshal to support them. Drax thought it was inconceivable that they should not ask for Soviet help. He added, not very diplomatically, it would seem, that if they did not ask for help when necessary and allow themselves to be overrun, it may be expected that they would become German provinces. This was the last thing the Russians wanted, for it meant the presence of the Nazi armies on the Soviet border, and Voroshilov made a special point of the admiral's unfortunate remark. Finally, the uncomfortable Anglo-French representatives contended that Voroshilov had raised political questions which they were not competent to handle. Drax declared that since Poland was a sovereign state, its government would first have to sanction the entry of Russian troops. But since this was a political matter, it would have to be settled by the governments. He suggested that the Soviet government put its questions to the Polish government. The Russian delegation agreed that this was a political matter, but it insisted that the British and French governments must put the question to the Poles and pressure them to come to reason. Were the Russians, in view of their dealings with the Germans at this moment, negotiating in good faith with the Franco-British military representatives? Or did they, as the British and French foreign officers, not to mention Admiral Drax, later concluded, insist on the right to deploy their troops through Poland merely to stall the talks until they saw whether they could make a deal with Hitler? The timing is important. Molotov did not receive the Nazi proposal that Ribbentrop come to Moscow until the evening of August 15th. And though he did not accept it definitely, he did hint that Russia would be interested in a non-aggression pact with Germany, which of course would have made negotiation of a military alliance with France and Britain superfluous. The best conclusion this writer can come to is that, as of August 14th, when Voroshilov demanded an unequivocal answer to the question of allowing Soviet troops to meet the Germans in Poland, the Kremlin still had an open mind as to which side to join. Unfortunately, the Russian documents, which could clear up this crucial question, have not been published. At any rate, Stalin does not seem to have made his final decision until the afternoon of August 19th. In the beginning, the British and French confidential sources reveal, the Western Allies did think that the Soviet military delegation was negotiating in good faith. In fact, that it took its job much too seriously. On August 13th, after 2 days of staff talks, Ambassador Seeds wired London that the Russian military chiefs seemed really to be out for business. As a result, Admiral Drax's instructions to go very slowly were changed, and on August 15th he was told by the British government to support Dumont in bringing the military talks to a conclusion as soon as possible. His restrictions on confiding confidential military information to the Russians were partially lifted. Unlike the British admiral's original instructions to stall, those given General Dumont by Premier Daladier personally had been to try to conclude a military convention with Russia at the earliest possible moment. Despite British fears of leaks to the Germans, Dumont on the second day of the meetings had confided to the Russians such highly secret figures, as he termed them, on the strength of the French army, that the Soviet members promised to forget them as soon as the meeting was concluded. As late as August 17th, after he and Drax had waited vainly for 3 days for instructions from their governments as to how to reply to the Polish question, General Dumont telegraphed Paris, "The USSR wants a military pact. She does not want us to give her a piece of paper without substantial undertakings. Marshal Voroshilov has stated that all problems would be tackled without difficulty as soon as what he called the crucial question was settled." Dumont strongly urged Paris to get Warsaw to agree to accepting Russian help. Contrary to a widespread belief at the time, not only in Moscow but in the Western capitals, that the British and French governments did nothing to induce the Poles to agree to Soviet troops meeting the Germans on Polish soil, it is clear from documents recently released that London and Paris went quite far, but not quite far enough. It is also clear that the Poles reacted with unbelievable stupidity. On August 18th, after the first Anglo-French attempt was made in Warsaw to open the eyes of the Poles, Foreign Minister Beck told the French ambassador, Léon Noël, that the Russians were of no military value, and General Stakhovich, chief of the Polish General Staff, backed him up by declaring that he saw no benefit to be gained by Red Army troops operating in Poland. The next day, both the British and French ambassadors saw Beck again and urged him to agree to the Russian proposal. The Polish foreign minister stalled, but promised to give them a formal reply the next day. The Anglo-French démarche in Warsaw came as the result of a conversation earlier on the 19th in Paris between Bonnet, the French foreign minister, and the British chargé d'affaires. Somewhat to the Britons' surprise, this arch-appeaser of Hitler was now quite aroused to the prospect of losing Russia as an ally because of Polish stubbornness. It would be disastrous, Bonnet told him, if, in consequence of a Polish refusal, the Russian negotiations were to break down. It was an untenable position for the Poles to take up in refusing the only immediate efficacious help that could reach them in the event of a German attack. It would put the British and French governments in an almost impossible position if we had to ask our respective countries to go to war in defense of Poland, which had refused this help. If this were so, and there is no doubt that it was, why then did not the British and French governments at this crucial moment put the ultimate pressure on Warsaw and simply say that unless the Polish government agreed to accept Russian help, Britain and France could see no use of themselves going to war to aid Poland? The formal Anglo-Polish Mutual Security Treaty had not yet been signed. Could Warsaw's acceptance of Russian military backing not be made a condition of concluding that pact? Lloyd George, in a speech in the Commons on April 3rd, 4 days after Chamberlain's unilateral guarantee to Poland had been announced, had urged the British government to make such a condition. If we are going in without the help of Russia, we are walking into a trap. It is the only country whose armies can get there, to Poland. I cannot understand why, before committing ourselves to this tremendous enterprise, we did not secure beforehand the adhesion of Russia. If Russia has not been brought into this matter because of certain feelings the Poles have that they do not want the Russians there, it is for us to declare the conditions, and unless the Poles are prepared to accept the only conditions with which we can successfully help them, the responsibility must be theirs. In his talk with the British chargé in Paris on August 19th, Bonnet suggested this, but the government in London frowned upon such a maneuver, as Downing Street called it. To such an extreme, Chamberlain and Halifax would not go. On the morning of August 20th, the Polish chief of staff informed the British military attaché in Warsaw that in no case would the admission of Soviet troops into Poland be agreed to. And that evening, Beck formally rejected the Anglo-French request. The same evening, Halifax, through his ambassador in Warsaw, urged the Polish foreign minister to reconsider, emphasizing in strong terms that the Polish stand was wrecking the military talks in Moscow. But Beck was obdurate. "I do not admit," he told the French ambassador, "that there can be any kind of discussion whatsoever concerning the use of part of our territory by foreign troops. We have not got a military agreement with the USSR. We do not want one." Desperate at such a display of blind stubbornness on the part of the Polish government, Premier Daladier, according to an account he gave to the French Constituent Assembly on July 18, 1946, took matters in his own hands. After once more appealing to the Poles to be realistic, he telegraphed General Dumont on the morning of August 21st, authorizing him to sign a military convention with Russia on the best terms he could get, with the provision, however, that it must be approved by the French government. The French ambassador, Paul-Émile Najar, was at the same time instructed by Bonnet, according to the latter's subsequent account, to tell Molotov that France agreed in principle to the passage of Soviet troops through Poland if the Germans attacked. But this was only an idle gesture as long as the Poles had not agreed, and, as we know now, a futile gesture in view of the state of Russo-German dealings. Dumont did not receive Daladier's telegram until late in the evening of August 21st. When he brought it to the attention of Voroshilov on the evening of the next day, the eve of Ribbentrop's departure from Moscow, the Soviet marshal was highly skeptical. He demanded to see the French general's authorization for saying, as Dumont had, that the French government had empowered him to sign a military pact permitting the passage of Russian troops through Poland. Dumont obviously declined. Voroshilov next wanted to know what the British response was and whether the consent of Poland had been obtained. These were embarrassing questions, and Dumont merely answered that he had no information. But neither the questions nor the answers had by this time any reality. They were being put too late. Ribbentrop was already on his way to Moscow. The trip had been announced publicly the night before, and also its purpose, to conclude a non-aggression pact between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Voroshilov, who seems to have developed a genuine liking for the French general, tried gently to let him know that their contacts were about to end. "I fear one thing," Voroshilov said. "The French and English sides have allowed the political and military discussions to drag on too long. That is why we must not exclude the possibility, during this time, of certain political events." At a session of the military delegates the morning before, on August 21st, Voroshilov had demanded the indefinite adjournment of the talks on the excuse that he and his colleagues would be busy with the autumn maneuvers. To the Anglo-French protests at such a delay, the marshal had answered, "The intentions of the Soviet delegation were, and still are, to agree on the organization of military cooperation of the armed forces of the three parties. The USSR, not having a common frontier with Germany, can give help to France, Britain, Poland, and Romania only on condition that her troops are given rights of passage across Polish and Romanian territory. The Soviet forces cannot cooperate with the armed forces of Britain and France if they are not allowed onto Polish and Romanian territory. The Soviet military delegation cannot picture to itself how the governments and general staffs of Britain and France, in sending their missions to the USSR, could not have given them some directives on such an elementary matter. This can only show that there are reasons to doubt their desire to come to serious and effective cooperation with the USSR. The logic of the Marshal's military argument was sound, and the failure of the French, and especially the British governments, to answer it would prove disastrous. But to have repeated it, with all the rest of the statement, on this late date, August 21st, when Voroshilov could not have been ignorant of Stalin's decision of August 19th, was deceitful. Ribbentrop in Moscow, August 23, 1939. Those certain political events now took place. Armed with full powers in writing from Hitler to conclude a non-aggression treaty and other agreements with the Soviet Union, which would become effective as soon as they were signed, Ribbentrop set off by plane from Moscow on August 22nd. The large German party spent the night at Königsberg in East Prussia, where the Nazi foreign minister, according to Dr. Schmidt, worked throughout the night, constantly telephoning to Berlin and Berchtesgaden and making copious notes for his talks with Stalin and Molotov. The two large Condor transport planes carrying the German delegation arrived in Moscow at noon on August 23rd, and after a hasty meal at the embassy, Ribbentrop hurried off to the Kremlin to confront the Soviet dictator and his foreign commissar. This first meeting lasted 3 hours, and, as Ribbentrop advised Hitler by most urgent wire, it went well for the Germans. Judging by the foreign minister's dispatch, there was no trouble at all in reaching agreement on the terms of a non-aggression pact which would keep the Soviet Union out of Hitler's war. In fact, the only difficulty, he reported, was a distinctly minor one concerning the division of spoils. The Russians, he said, were demanding that Germany recognize the small ports of Libau and Vindau in Latvia as being in their sphere of interest. Since all of Latvia was to be placed on the Soviet side of the line dividing the interests of the two powers, this demand presented no problem, and Hitler quickly agreed. Ribbentrop also advised the Führer after the first conference that the signing of a secret protocol on the delimitation of mutual spheres of interest in the whole eastern area is contemplated. The whole works, the non-aggression treaty and the secret protocol, were signed at a second meeting at the Kremlin later that evening. So easily had the Germans and Russians come to agreement that this convivial session, which lasted into the small hours of the following morning, was taken up mostly not by any hard bargaining, but with a warm and friendly discussion of the state of the world, country by country, and with the inevitable effusive toasts customary at gala gatherings in the Kremlin. A secret German memorandum by a member of the German delegation who was present has recorded the incredible scene. To Stalin's questions about the ambitions of Germany's partners, Italy and Japan, Ribbentrop gave breezy, reassuring answers. As to England, the Soviet dictator and the Nazi foreign minister, who was now on his best behavior, found themselves at once in accord. The British military mission in Moscow, Stalin confided to his guest, had never told the Soviet government what it really wanted. Ribbentrop responded by emphasizing that Britain had always tried to disrupt good relations between Germany and the Soviet Union. "England is weak," he boasted, "and wants to let others fight for her presumptuous claim to world dominion." Stalin eagerly concurred, says the German memorandum, and he remarked, "If England dominated the world, that was due to the stupidity of the other countries that always let themselves be bluffed." By this time, the Soviet ruler and Hitler's foreign minister were getting along so splendidly that mention of the Anti-Comintern Pact no longer embarrassed them. Ribbentrop explained again that the pact had been directed not against Russia, but against the Western democracies. Stalin interposed to remark that the Anti-Comintern had in fact frightened principally the city of London, i.e. the British financiers, and the English shopkeepers. At this juncture, the German memorandum reveals, Ribbentrop felt himself in such good humor at Stalin's accommodating manner that he even tried to crack a joke or two, a remarkable feat for so humorless a man. The Reich foreign minister, the memorandum continues, remarked jokingly that Monsieur Stalin was surely less frightened by the Anti-Comintern Pact than the city of London and the English shopkeepers. What the German people thought of this matter was evident from a joke which had originated with the Berliners, well known for their wit and humor, that Stalin will yet join the Anti-Comintern Pact himself. Finally, the Nazi foreign minister dwelt on how warmly the German people welcomed an understanding with Russia. "Monsieur Stalin replied," says the German record, "that he really believed this, the Germans desired peace. Such hokum grew worse as the time for toasts arrived. Monsieur Stalin spontaneously proposed a toast to the Führer. "I know how much the German nation loves its Führer. I should therefore like to drink to his health." Monsieur Molotov drank to the health of the Reich Foreign Minister. Messieurs Molotov and Stalin drank repeatedly to the Non-Aggression Pact, the new era of German-Russian relations, and to the German nation. The Reich Foreign Minister, in turn, proposed a toast to Monsieur Stalin, toasts to the Soviet government, and to a favorable development of relations between Germany and the Soviet Union. And yet, despite such warm exchanges between those who until recently had been such mortal enemies, Stalin appears to have had mental reservations about the Nazis keeping the pact. As Ribbentrop was leaving, he took him aside and said, "The Soviet government take the new pact very seriously. He could guarantee on his word of honor that the Soviet Union would not betray its partner." What had the new partners signed? The published treaty carried an undertaking that neither power would attack the other. Should one of them become the object of belligerent action by a third power, the other party would in no manner lend its support to this third power, nor would either Germany or Russia join any grouping of powers whatsoever which is aimed directly or indirectly at the other party. The wording of the essential articles is almost identical to that of a Soviet draft which Molotov handed Schulenburg on August 19th, and which Hitler, in his telegram to Stalin, said he accepted. The Russian draft had specified that the non-aggression treaty would be valid only if a special protocol were signed simultaneously and made an integral part of the pact. According to Friedrich Gauss, who participated at the evening meeting, a highfalutin preamble which Ribbentrop wanted to insert, stressing the formation of friendly Soviet-German relations, was thrown out at the insistence of Stalin. The Soviet dictator complained that the Soviet government could not suddenly present to the public assurances of friendship after they had been covered with pails of manure by the Nazi government for 6 years. Thus, Hitler got what he specifically wanted, an immediate agreement by the Soviet Union not to join Britain and France if they honored their treaty obligations to come to the aid of Poland in case she were attacked. Article 7 provided for the treaty to enter into force immediately upon signature. Formal ratification in two such totalitarian states was, to be sure, a mere formality. But it would take a few days. Hitler had insisted on this provision. The price he paid was set down in the secret additional protocol to the treaty. On the occasion of the signature of the non-aggression treaty between Germany and the Soviet Union, the undersigned plenipotentiaries discussed in strictly confidential conversations the question of the delimitation of their respective spheres of interest in Eastern Europe. 1. In the event of a territorial and political transformation in the territories belonging to the Baltic states, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the northern frontier of Lithuania shall represent the frontier of the spheres of interest both of Germany and the USSR. 2. In the event of a territorial and political transformation of the territories belonging to the Polish state, the spheres of interest of both Germany and the USSR shall be bounded approximately by the line of the rivers Narew, Vistula, and San. The question whether the interests of both parties make the maintenance of an independent Polish state appear desirable, and how the frontiers of this state should be drawn, can be definitely determined only in the course of further political developments. In any case, both governments will resolve this question by means of a friendly understanding. Once again, Germany and Russia, as in the days of the German kings and Russian emperors, had agreed to partition Poland, and Hitler had given Stalin a free hand in the Eastern Baltic. Finally, in southeastern Europe, the Russians emphasized their interest in Bessarabia, which the Soviet Union had lost to Romania in 1919, and the Germans declared their disinterest in this territory, a concession Ribbentrop later was to regret. This protocol, the document concluded, will be treated by both parties as strictly secret. As a matter of fact, its contents became known only after the war with the capture of the secret German archives. On the following day, August 24th, while the jubilant Ribbentrop was winging his way back to Berlin, the Allied military missions in Moscow requested to see Voroshilov. Admiral Drax had actually sent an urgent letter to the marshal requesting his views on the continuation of their talks. Voroshilov gave them to the British and French military staffs at 1 p.m. the next day, August 25th. "In view of the changed political situation," he said, "no useful purpose can be served in continuing the conversations." 2 years later, when German troops were pouring into Russia in violation of the pact, Stalin would still justify his odious deal with Hitler, made behind the backs of the Anglo-French military delegations which had come to negotiate in Moscow. "We secured peace for our country for 1.5 years," he boasted in a broadcast to the Russian people on July 3, 1941, "as well as an opportunity of preparing our forces for defense if fascist Germany risked attacking our country in defiance of the pact. This was a definite gain for our country and a loss for fascist Germany." But was it? The point has been debated ever since, that the sordid secret deal gave Stalin the same breathing space, Pyaradishka, which Tsar Alexander I had secured from Napoleon at Tilsit in 1807, and Lenin from the Germans at Brest-Litovsk in 1917, was obvious. Within a short time, it also gave the Soviet Union an advanced defensive position against Germany beyond the existing Russian frontiers, including bases in the Baltic states and Finland, at the expense of the Poles, Latvians, Estonians, and Finns. And most important of all, as the official Soviet History of Diplomacy later emphasized, it assured the Kremlin that if Russia were later attacked by Germany, the Western powers would already be irrevocably committed against the Third Reich, and the Soviet Union would not stand alone against the German might, as Stalin had feared throughout the summer of 1939. All this is undoubtedly true, but there is another side to the argument. By the time Hitler got around to attacking Russia, the armies of Poland and France and the British Expeditionary Force on the continent had been destroyed, and Germany had the resources of all of Europe to draw upon, and no Western front to tie her hands. All through 1941, 1942, and 1943, Stalin was to complain bitterly that there was no second front in Europe against Germany, and that Russia was forced to bear the brunt of containing almost the entire German army. In 1939-40, there was a Western front to draw off the German forces, and Poland could not have been overrun in a fortnight if the Russians had backed her instead of stabbing her in the back. Moreover, there might not have been any war at all if Hitler had known he must take on Russia as well as Poland, England, and France. Even the politically timid German generals, if one can judge from their later testimony at Nuremberg, might have put their foot down against embarking on war against such a formidable coalition. Toward the end of May, according to the French ambassador in Berlin, both Keitel and Brauchitsch had warned Hitler that Germany had little chance of winning a war in which Russia participated on the enemy side. No statesmen, not even dictators, can foretell the course of events over the long run. It is arguable, as Churchill has argued, that cold-blooded as Stalin's move was in making a deal with Hitler, it was also, at the moment, realistic in a high degree. Stalin's first and primary consideration, as was that of any other head of government, was his nation's security. He was convinced in the summer of 1939, as he later told Churchill, that Hitler was going to war. He was determined that Russia should not be maneuvered into the disastrous position of having to face the German army alone. If a foolproof alliance with the West proved impossible, then why not turn to Hitler, who suddenly was knocking at his door? By the end of July 1939, Stalin had become convinced, it is obvious, not only that France and Britain did not want a binding alliance, but that the objective of the Chamberlain government in Britain was to induce Hitler to make his wars in Eastern Europe. He seems to have been intensely skeptical that Britain would honor its guarantee to Poland any more than France had kept its obligations to Czechoslovakia. And everything that had happened in the West for the past 2 years tended to increase his suspicions. The rejection by Chamberlain of Soviet proposals after the Anschluss and after the Nazi occupation of Czechoslovakia, for conferences to draw up plans to halt further Nazi aggression, Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler at Munich, from which Russia had been excluded, the delays and hesitations of Chamberlain in negotiating a defensive alliance against Germany as the fateful summer days of 1939 ticked by. One thing was certain, to almost everyone but Chamberlain: the bankruptcy of Anglo-French diplomacy, which had faltered and tottered whenever Hitler made a move, was now complete. And of Polish diplomacy, too. Ambassador Noel reported Foreign Minister Beck's reaction to the signing of the Nazi-Soviet pact in a dispatch to Paris. Beck is quite unperturbed and does not seem in the slightest worried. He believes that, in substance, very little has changed. Step by step, the two Western democracies had retreated. When Hitler defied them by declaring conscription in 1935, when he occupied the Rhineland in 1936, when he took Austria in 1938, and in the same year demanded and got the Sudetenland. And they had sat by weakly when he occupied the rest of Czechoslovakia in March 1939. With the Soviet Union on their side, they still might have dissuaded the German dictator from launching war, or, if that failed, have fairly quickly defeated him in an armed conflict. But they had allowed this last opportunity to slip out of their hands, despite many warnings, as we have seen, that Hitler was courting the Kremlin. On June 1st, Monsieur Coulandre, the French ambassador in Berlin, had informed Bonnet, the French foreign minister, that Russia was looming larger and larger in Hitler's thoughts. "Hitler will risk war," Coulandre wrote, "if he does not have to fight Russia. On the other hand, if he knows he has to fight her too, he will draw back rather than expose his country, his party, and himself to ruin." The ambassador urged the prompt conclusion of the Anglo-French negotiations in Moscow and advised Paris that the British ambassador in Berlin had made a similar appeal to his government in London. French Yellow Book, French edition, pages 180-181. On August 15th, both Coulandre and Henderson saw Weizsäcker at the Foreign Office. The British ambassador informed London that the State Secretary was confident that the Soviet Union would in the end join in sharing the Polish spoils. British Blue Book, page 91. And Coulandre, after his talk with Weizsäcker, wired Paris, "It is necessary at all costs to come to some solution of the Russian talks as soon as possible." French Yellow Book, page 282. Throughout June and July, Lawrence Steinhardt, the American ambassador in Moscow, had also sent warnings of an impending Soviet-Nazi deal, which President Roosevelt passed on to the British, French, and Polish embassies. As early as July 5th, when Soviet Ambassador Konstantin Umansky left for a leave in Russia, he carried with him a message from Roosevelt to Stalin that if his government joined up with Hitler, it was as certain as that the night followed day that as soon as Hitler had conquered France, he would turn on Russia. Joseph E. Davies, Mission to Moscow, page 450. The president's warning was cabled to Steinhardt with instructions to repeat it to Molotov, which the ambassador did on August 16th. U.S. Diplomatic Papers, 1939, Volume 1, pages 296-299. Now, at the worst possible time, in the worst possible circumstances, they were committed to come to the aid of Poland when she was attacked. The recriminations in London and Paris against the double-dealing of Stalin were loud and bitter. The Soviet despot for years had cried out at the fascist beasts and called for all peace-loving states to band together to halt Nazi aggression. Now he had made himself an accessory to it. The Kremlin could argue, as it did, that the Soviet Union had only done what Britain and France had done the year before at Munich, bought peace and the time to rearm against Germany at the expense of a small state. If Chamberlain was right and honorable in appeasing Hitler in September 1938 by sacrificing Czechoslovakia, was Stalin wrong and dishonorable in appeasing the Führer a year later at the expense of Poland, which had shunned Soviet help anyway? Stalin's cynical and secret deal with Hitler to divide up Poland and to obtain a free hand to gobble up Latvia, Estonia, Finland, and Bessarabia was not known outside Berlin and Moscow, but it would soon become evident from Soviet acts, and it would shock most of the world even at this late date. The Russians might say, as they did, that they were only repossessing territories which had been taken away from them at the end of the First World War, but the peoples of these lands were not Russian and had shown no desire to return to Russia. Only force, which the Soviets had eschewed in the heyday of Litvinov, could make them return. Since joining the League of Nations, the Soviet Union had built up a certain moral force as the champion of peace and the leading opponent of fascist aggression. Now that moral capital had been utterly dissipated. Above all, by assenting to a shoddy deal with Nazi Germany, Stalin had given the signal for the commencement of a war that almost certainly would develop into a world conflict. This he certainly knew. Years before, Hitler had written prophetically in Mein Kampf, "The very fact of the conclusion of an alliance with Russia embodies a plan for the next war. Its outcome would be the end of Germany." See page 660 of the Houghton Mifflin edition, 1943. As things turned out, it was the greatest blunder of his life.